The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. This is Garner Ted Armstrong with the good news of the world tomorrow. Just where are you going in your personal life in the light of this fantastic world you live in, where it's nothing but fear and worry, wars and more wars, upset weather, and the big picture is so frightening, most of us seem desperately concerned not to look at it. And so pollsters pretty much prove this is true of people when they ask a group of passersby on the street, just what do you want to get out of life? A maintenance man said, first of all, I'd like to have enough money to pay all my bills, to give me enough so that I wouldn't have any future financial worries. With money, he philosophized, you can find an awful lot of happiness or else you can be unhappy in style. A young man working in communication said security is what he wanted. With security, he said, you relieve a lot of the tension in life and actually achieve contentment. I feel that a good, steady job that I enjoy doing is the key to gaining security. I just want to get by with an average standard of living. A young secretary had the rather wistful idea of a lot of girls of today. She said, I'm looking for success in my new job, but like most girls, I want a happy marriage and a home in the country with enough ground for a pony for my children. Now, you talk about the classic idea of millions of New Yorkers and people in Chicago and people from Bloemfontein to Boston and Johannesburg to Los Angeles. That's even being laughed at in some of the big weekly news magazines of today, the sort of a wistful yearning of a lot of big city people for the little picket fence and the pony and the carrot patch and all of the space to breathe free air. A foundry man working in a foundry said, happiness, that's about all. Happiness is all that is necessary. I guess you might call it contentment. You know, this almost obsessive drive to become concerned with only our personal problems is pretty much indicative of the way the world is headed today. Most people today are absolutely scared out of their wits about the big picture, and they refuse to look at it. We see nothing but wars and rumors of more wars. We're very much concerned about Vietnam escalating into a massive land war with Asia, with the communist Chinese. We're fantastically concerned about government spending, about the policies of government today of trying to feed the world, about the possibility of 12 million people starving to death in India, about the possibility of 40 nations by the 1980s having the atomic bomb. And we're so concerned with a really big picture that we try desperately to become unconcerned with it. It's paradoxical. But everybody tries almost desperately to become absorbed with normal day-to-day things, trying at all costs to keep from thinking about the big picture. So today people want happiness, and they want it by trying to cloud their minds from the facts, trying to sink deeply into their own personal little rut of life and get theirs while the getting is good. Today we think, for some unknown reason, that happiness is something you seize. Happiness is something you shop for like a commodity. It's something you look for, something you find. Because of this intense drive for happiness and security and the emphasis on the good life, a boy up in Detroit said, I want to get ahead and I'll step on people to do it. Money is important to me, he said. I enjoy the good things and I don't want to have to work a whole lifetime to enjoy them. I want to be successful. Doesn't that pretty much express it the way a lot of people would? A survey conducted by Printers, Inc. magazine revealed that 76% of the advertising industry's executives who make over $25,000 a year are unhappy in their jobs. How do you figure that one? Millions of you people listening don't make anywhere near $25,000 a year. You figure if you made that kind of money, you'd be deliriously happy. The wife could have a mink stole. You might put a pool in the yard over the next couple of years. You could buy that second or even third automobile. You would be deliriously happy, so you think. But those who are making that kind of money say they're not. And more than 21% of those interviewed blame their gloom on the belief, and this maybe is indicative of advertising, I don't know, that they were underpaid. Now, maybe advertisers, these are the people who make up your cigarette ads you hear and the booze ads and the rest of it that you listen to all the time. Things that they advertise these things to make you smell good to your girl and bad to mosquitoes. You've heard it all the time. And most of them apparently feel they are underpaid. Now, isn't that something? You read today in some of the magazines, happiness jokes. Happiness is this and that. And, you know, most of the time, happiness is defined as something like finding a full bottle of booze somebody left behind at the office party, or finding out that the fella's wife is going to stay an extra 2 weeks with mother just as a new girl moved into the neighborhood or something like this. That's right. It's supposed to be laughable or funny. And yet every single one of these happiness jokes shows a person with some kind of an unexpected windfall, some money, some little bit of licentiousness, some opportunity for some devilment of some kind or another, which is sensually or physically satisfying, or at least so people think. Now, you want happiness, too. So does everybody else. But what is happiness? What is success, security, peace of mind? Just what is this thing people seek in life? Is it a commodity you can buy? There's a big yawning ache in most people. A sense of unfulfillment, of desire unsatisfied, of wanting to do something, go somewhere, see something, say something, experience something. But never quite. It's sort of like the frustration of being 17. Now, if you're not 17, you might remember back how it was. You weren't so desperate to keep your voice from cracking when you asked that girl for the date, and you wish these rotten pimples weren't on your face, and you wish you knew what to do with your hands and what to do with your shoes, and you want to look good so bad and you can't, and you know, you worry about everything from B.O. to tousled hair, and you hope that maybe you can find that magic hair cream where a little gob will goo you and every woman on the street will want to muss your hair. And it's a sort of a frantic age. It drives you crazy. Now, let's face it. There's a yawning, nagging, gnawing ache in most people for fulfillment, for success, for popularity, for experience. We want to be fulfilled. We want to really have a good life. The way this boy expressed it, I want to get ahead and I'll step on people to do it. He didn't quite know what he meant by that. He didn't quite know what he meant about stepping on people. He just had heard other people say this, and he assumed that at some time or another in his job, he would have an opportunity to do this. But let's face it, people don't know how to be happy, don't know what happiness is, yet they want happiness. But happiness is regulated by laws. There are living, active, dynamic laws that regulate happiness and that would produce it if you would obey them. But much of the world remains in ignorance of these laws, and all you need to do to prove that point is to take a good, honest look at the world around you, at you yourself, at the people closest to you. How happy, how serene, how filled with a sense of well-being and direction are they? How much courage? How peaceful are they? You take a look at a lot of teenagers I know. I know a lot of happy teenagers, but of course I know some unhappy ones too. And you can find this expressed nowhere quite so well as in looking at teenage music today. Help me, it says. It screeches, please help me. It says, I need to hold your hand. And who are they talking about? Each other? I'm not clear on that. Anyhow, it's a weep and a wail. It's a screech and a moan. It's a mournful complaint, a plaintive cry, a nagging, begging, pleading call for help. You hear it all the time. It's always in that same minor key. It never quite ends. You don't know if it starts and ends. It's like somebody turning on a printing press. Have you ever heard a great big machine rumbling with a clacking and grinding of gears that sets up a kind of a tempo that never ceases and never changes? Somebody presses a button and the machine begins. That's the way a lot of music affects me today. It's a lonesome dirge of something unfulfilled, something being missed, something not quite reached. Now, I'm not kidding you. You can listen to it for yourself, and that's the way it leaves you. It just sort of leaves you hanging. It's called unresolved dissonance, I think. It doesn't inspire confidence. It doesn't inspire courage. It doesn't inspire peace of mind or contentment. Oh, it might make you want to jerk your sacroiliac out of shape, or flop your head, or stomp your feet, or wag or wave your elbows like a chicken. But it's kind of like sour pickles and green persimmons and a mosquito bite you can't quite reach. At least that's the way it affects most people, it seems to me. It's another sign of the times we live in. It's a clue to the attitude of people, a gauge to their emotions. How do people feel today? Well, just like a lot of this music expresses it. Help me. I'm in trouble. I'm unrequited. I'm unfulfilled. I'm unhappy. I'm missing out on life. I want to hold somebody's hand because I'm afraid of people walking down the street. A mournful wail and a dirge of helplessness, and that pretty well expresses the way people feel today. Well, there is a way out of it, but most people aren't willing to look to the one source that would give it to them. because most people would turn up their lip in sneers if they heard that the one way to peace and happiness and fulfillment is to discover the laws, the spiritual laws that produce these things in life. And those spiritual laws are revealed, and they are active, they live, they're dynamic, and I don't care whether people don't believe them or like to scoff at them or not, they're there. And they act, and you don't even need to be ignorant of them or know them to have them act upon you. Now, whether you as a youngster know the laws that regulate sex and marriage, and whether you know there are living, dynamic laws that are just as dependable as the law of gravity that regulate happiness in marriage, doesn't mean, you know, you just don't have to know the laws are there in order for those laws to come crashing down on you and wreck your life. Maybe some little gal somewhere in some big city comes home some night and says, "Mom, I'm in trouble." And maybe she just honestly hadn't been given much education and didn't know how she could get herself in trouble. She didn't have to know. It's pretty irrevocable, isn't it, the time when somebody says, "I'm in trouble." There's just not much turning back at that point, is there, knowing the laws of life? But it's too bad that a lot of people aren't taught those laws in advance. Now, those laws are found, believe it or not, in the Bible. The Bible is scoffed and impugned and ridiculed today as being Hebrew literature, as being out of date, and being completely useless to us in this space age, yet at the same time we claim the Bible is useless, here we are singing, "Help me. I'm in trouble. I want to hold your hand," or some such little tidbit of forlorn idiocy. Now, you're free to find out for yourself what the best ways are to live. I mean, you're free to experiment. We had a letter I told you about from a teenager that said, "I think religion is for you old folks who are about ready to die, and I want to be free to make my mistakes." And, of course, she is free to make her mistakes, and so are you, and so am I. We're free to live the way we want. But what really pays off? What is worth having? What is really worth living for? Do you know? You're a free moral agent. You can pick and choose for yourself. You can either look into the Bible, you can find out whether or not the Bible is true, or you can decide for yourself, based upon no knowledge, based upon no proof and no research, that the Bible is not true, and you can go on living in a way that makes you miserable and unhappy. Or you can write for these booklets, "Does God Exist?" and the proof of the Bible, and get that proved, first of all. You didn't know, probably, that the Bible has laws concerning teaching teenagers sex education. You probably didn't know there are laws in the Bible regulating landmarks, farming, inheritances, finances, laws about diet, health, and exercise, laws about the marriage and the home, child rearing. And they're not casual suggestions, and they are not yardsticks by which other people in the community will say you are a good fellow or an active Christian. That's not the point. The Bible is not written as a book to tuck under your arm and argue religion with somebody else. They aren't just casual suggestions, or the difference between somebody who is thought of by other people as being good or bad. But today there's a vast sort of a disillusionment afoot. People are saying, and it's pretty well expressed by this one question, living in a world such as this is, how can I have faith in God? Now, isn't that a dumb question? No, it is when you analyze it. I know people don't think it's dumb at first, but it is when you stop to think about it, because here's what's behind it. People look at other people. That is, they look at the way people are living their lives. And they see people miserable, and people committing suicide, and people getting divorces, and people saying, "Sure, I cheat, why shouldn't I? Everybody else does." And they see people living contrary to the laws of God, and then they turn right around, and based upon what they see other people doing, they say, "God must be out of date." They say, "Therefore, there must not be any laws. Therefore, because people are evil, there must not be a God. And because people are guilty of causing accidents, and because people hit little children with their runaway automobiles, and because people can be guilty of slipshod workmanship, careless maintenance, belting down booze before they drive an automobile, because people can cause the death, the injury, or something else to happen to an innocent bystander, therefore there must not be a God." Now that's sort of ridiculous reasoning, isn't it? And what's behind it? Well, as I said in recent programs, people assume this is God's world. They assume there is some kind of a fantastic struggle between God and the devil, if there be such people, or such creatures, such beings. And they assume that God is doing all he honestly can, by every means at his disposal, to save this world, and to make people live the right way. They don't seem to realize God reveals in His Word, if we take the trouble to read it, that He's keeping hands off, that He is not interfering or intervening in this world today, except one little bit here and there is necessary to work out His program and His purpose. But He's not trying to live people's lives for them at all. He's letting them make up their own mind and live the way they wish. Now, that's the answer to it, if you have the wit to see it and can look in the Bible and prove that to yourself. Why did Jesus say in Matthew 10 and verse 34, "Think not I am come to bring peace on earth. I came not to bring peace, but a sword." Why did He tell His own disciples? He spoke in similes and parables so people could not understand. He didn't want them to get the meaning. He wanted them to remain in ignorance of what He meant, because He said He didn't want them to turn and repent and be converted. Does that sound like the Christ you've heard about? The broken-hearted, mournful Christ? The one that plods along on your trail all your life and tries to capture little old ladies in gray felt hats in dimly lit interiors and try to get them into heaven? I mean, that's the way the average teenagers look at it, and that's not right, and that's not the way God has it. But that's the way people have it. You know it, and I know it, and that's the way it looks to me. I see people who like to burn the candle at both ends and live their lives riotously and go the way of the line of least resistance. And then, when all is said and done, and their liver is given out, and their heart is just missing a beat every now and then, and maybe their kidneys have been operated on, and some gallstones have been removed, and maybe they have lost sight in one eye, and the other is getting bad, and their hearing is just about shot. Now they're ready for God. You know, you've heard this, you've seen it, you've witnessed it all around you all your life. Now they're ready to give God a try. The doctor says, "I've done all I can for you. This is all that medical science can do. Let us pray," somebody always says about this time. And so, of course, when you see this around you, you see people that have no use for God, except that finally, when they realize life is about over, "Now I think I'll get religion." You ever wonder why it is? You look at so many, many different groups of people who embrace this or that religion or another, and it seems like there are so many elderly people. And this is the way the teenager looks at it. That's why this young teenager wrote in and told us that she felt religion was for old, old people. Now, she might be shocked to see the youngsters around the three Ambassador College campuses, if it isn't a shame to call them youngsters, and to see the youth that is around those college campuses, and to see the fact that there are quite a large number of people who are beginning to live by the laws of God with His help, and who are youthful, and who keep their zest and their youth and the spring in their step, even on up into their 70s, and where it is not a group of people who are elderly and waiting for death. But you know, when you look around the way people are living it, that's the way it appears to me, and that's the way it appears to you, and that's why you get disgusted about it, because you think religion is sort of the swan song for the dying, that religion is the faithful, plodding God who is trying His very level best to track you down to your deathbed to get you to say, "I repent," before you die. But have you ever looked into what the Bible says for yourself? Have you ever asked yourself this question? Could all of these different religions be right? Now, if any one of them is right, then all the others are wrong. People always phrase it a different way. Well, surely all these people can't be wrong. Just the other day, I saw a used car salesman try to use that again, and if I'd been able to, I would have laughed at him, but of course he was on television. I did anyhow, but I couldn't to his face. He said, "Surely all these people can't be wrong." He was quoting the number of people who had bought automobiles at his establishment. He said, "All these people," he said, "that many people can't be wrong." Now, what's he think about the Russians? There are a whole lot more Russians than there are people who bought his cars. Now, by his line of reasoning, he better buy himself a steamship ticket. You know, he doesn't really believe that, neither do you. We don't believe that all these people can't be wrong. Rather, we know that giant majorities can be wrong, and we base much of our life on that fact, that we know many times the majority can be wrong. So let's come off of it. We like to use whichever cliche is convenient at the time, you know, to get us our own way. No, why don't you ask it the other way? Not, well, surely all these people can't be wrong. That doesn't make sense. But the one that does make sense is, can all these different ideas about religion be right? No, they can't be, because they differ, because there are more than 400 different approaches to the Bible in the Western professing world of Christianity all by itself. Now, why don't you look into it for yourself? I've been getting into the book of Proverbs a little bit here in the last few programs. And the book of Proverbs is a guide for life. Rules for teenagers, primarily, because Solomon, the wise man who lived at that time, and God inspired him to write these laws, these regulations for living, wrote to his son. Now, his son, like a lot of sons, didn't pay much attention. He didn't pay much attention to his own father. He said in chapter 2, verse 1, my son. In chapter 3, verse 1, my son. And verse 11, my son. And verse 21, my son. And he said in chapter 4, verse 1, hear you children, the instruction of a father. But they don't, do they, Dad and Mom? They just don't very often. But you know, they would if you'd taught them from the time they are little children. They would if you'd asked them when they were little children to explain what's behind the light switch and what causes them to stand on the floor and why does a coin drop and how do sound waves travel and what's the moon made of and what causes it to rain and how does the sun come up and what's it made of and what keeps it up there and how does the earth rotate. They would if you'd taken them out and put a bean in the backyard and made them watch it grow, or stuck half of a yam in a glass of water and watched it grow. If you'd explain a little bit of household physics, like what causes the bubbles in the boiling pot of water, your children would know there is a God, and they wouldn't be hoodwinked by anybody saying otherwise. If you had explained it, that is, if you had been able to explain it, might be better. If you'd been able to explain it. You'd explain to them about their digestive system, circulatory system, nervous system, about their brain, their mind, about guarding it very carefully. If you had educated your children to a series of absolutes, then you could teach them, unlike Solomon. You know, Solomon didn't know one thing, apparently, looking at least at the example and what happened. Same thing a lot of people don't know today. That your children are going to do like you do, more than like you say. And as Solomon grew older, and with his 1,000 women around him, it was a little tough for his boy to look back on all his teaching about the wife of your youth. And here it is in the fifth chapter, you know, in the book of Proverbs, about how you shouldn't go off here after strange women. He said in verse 15, drink waters out of your own cistern and running waters out of your own well. And he talked about your wife of your youth, and he talked about the strange woman. Verse 20, he said, why wilt thou, my son, be ravished with a strange woman and embrace the bosom of a stranger? And he really talked about that, and that's right, that's the laws of God. But then in his own practice, the example that he set before his boy wasn't quite like his teaching. You know, people aren't very careful about what goes into their children's minds. They tell them, don't fight, and then Mom and Dad go at it in a hammer and tong argument. People might have a talking parrot they wouldn't let near a swearing man, but they'll let their children watch television by the hours, or look at these ridiculous comic books by the hours, and gobble down murder, mayhem, violence, or weird space-age science fiction. Pretty careless about what goes into their minds, aren't we? This book of Proverbs is a book of values, and not just wise thoughts, not nice sayings, but positive living laws. It's about time you began to teach your children these laws of life, and got into it verse by verse and explained it and expounded it. You know, it would be quite a challenge if you as a family were to open up your Bible in the morning and sit your family down and begin in Proverbs 1 and verse 1, let Dad read it, and then expound it and explain it. And if you can't do that, try to explain it away. It's impossible to do that either. A lot of people claim they don't believe in God. Well, they've never looked into it very far. I'm still of the opinion that there isn't any such thing as a real atheist. Not hanging upside down in a well, there's not. Not free falling from 21,000 feet, there isn't. Not stuck in the middle of a life raft in the vast Pacific, there's no such thing as an atheist. Not 21 days without a square meal, there isn't. Now, there might be in the comfort and security of somebody's library with his legs crossed and his thumbs hooked across a rather ample belly with his pet theories in mind and a cigar well lit and maybe brandy to hand. Sure, there can be an atheist then. But my Bible says only the fool has said in his heart there is no God. And I'll stick to that because I know that's a fact. Only the fool has said in his heart there is no God. Well, it's time you proved the facts and got it clear to yourself and began to teach your children. It's time you teenagers began to live by these laws and found out they really pay off. Found out what is happiness. How is it sought? What are the laws that produce it? Is life really worth living? Do you know that suicide is becoming the chief cause of death among teenagers? Ridiculous. One of the greatest ages ever to come to mankind, right in the age of the biggest challenge of all, and right on the brink of the greatest and broadest horizons of all. But the only way you could know that is by looking into the Bible. You sure couldn't tell that by looking at world conditions, I'll guarantee you. But there is a brighter world. That's what this program is all about. And here is a booklet that marches right on out into the future in step-by-step sequence and detail to show you what are the solutions to these problems, the good news beyond. The title of the booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. This booklet, more than anything else, tells you the exact reason for being for this radio program. People oftentimes wonder, well, what is this program? And what do they believe, and what do they stand for, and who's behind it, and who sponsors it, and just exactly what are they trying to get over? This booklet, more than any other piece of literature we could put in your hands, and it's all free, is going to tell you exactly what we believe, what we stand for, what we're trying to do, and here's the whole story of how it's going to come about. The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. Here are the two widely divergent views of politicians and government leaders, and then scientists, of what they secretly feel the world tomorrow is going to be like. Many of them feel it won't even be here. And then scientists talk about a wonderful, glittering, sort of a gigantic Disneyland of leisure, of more pleasure and ease and luxury for the few, but more starvation, more riots, more wars, more upsets for the many. But all the way through this booklet, you will see solutions. You will see the predictions about the outcome. You will see present-day trends and conditions in the big countries around this world analyzed and solved. You will see tomorrow's headlines today. You'll see the really big news that is not being reported anywhere else about the way this world is going to be. And included, one of the most fantastic newspapers you've ever read. Sort of a could-be newspaper, the way the world news could be today, and believe it or not, the way it will be in not very many more years. The best news you could read, an article about total disarmament. Articles about the solution to the big problems that everyone worries about today. Solving our economic problems, bringing people out of poverty, solving the racial hatreds and strife of people. Making wasteland productive. Solutions to the problems of weather, solving the problems of divorce, solving the problems of education and school dropouts, what have you. It's all here in this newspaper that is contained inside the booklet. Now, you don't have to ask for it separately. The booklet is entitled, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. It compares today's world with tomorrow's and shows you why it needs these solutions and exactly what they are. And there's a complete picture of it given. The exact conditions that will become extant. How we'll finally be totally delivered from the many problems that constantly confront us today. This booklet, as no other does, shows you exactly the meaning and the purpose of this broadcast, The World Tomorrow. That's why it's by the same title. The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. It's free of charge, no price, no one's going to call on you. We don't give your name to someone else. We protect it and safeguard it in our own IBM files. And we'll send it to you immediately upon receiving your request if you'll write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station and write for the booklet immediately. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.